Mondays with Mike.
I guess we'll go with Supreme Court first, because it's more of an in-depth thing, and you have a mind for that kind of detail. So, the Supreme Court ruled on Friday that lower courts are now limited in the degree to which they can issue nationwide injunctions. This 6-3 decision, I believe, was written by Amy Coney Barrett, and Justice Jackson wrote a dissent that said that this changes the game on judicial review. I'm certain I haven't completely explained the situation. Can you offer more explanation?
Yeah, this has to do... I'm not a huge fan of this decision, because the precedent that they're talking about goes all the way back to 1803. We're talking about something called judicial review with a case called Marbury versus Madison. This is one of the sort of foundational principles of the Supreme Court for, I don't know, over 200 and something years now. No, but yeah, longer. And I seriously disagree with the decision they've reached, because the first federal court that the United States ever had to deal with piracy. And piracy was an issue that dealt with the country had a fledgling navy at the time. And the very first clandestine operation that the country ever did was against the Barbary pirates of Tripoli. So a ship had run aground on a reef, and it was right off of the city of Tripoli. And the pirates captured just a ton of sailors and put them into slavery for ransom and all that. But anyways, that's a whole aside. That's a great story if you've never read of Eaton and the quest to return the sailors back from effectively slavery with the pirates. They're being held for ransom. But the point is that federal courts exist as a supra jurisdiction over state courts, right? It's a federalism issue. And so that's where you go if there's an issue that you have for things that specifically deal with the federal government. So things like interstate commerce and things like decisions that affect the whole country. And so when they say that these injunctions only exist within the like specific jurisdictions that they're talking about, that effectively limits the redress that people can have. And it's going to make it prohibitively expensive for people to actually access any level of review of what the government's doing, right? Because in order for you to get your case heard, you would have to have multiple jurisdictions effectively agree, and then the court would weigh in. And the whole point, that is how it works now anyways, is that you have one court issues a nationwide injunction, whatever, and then another court says, well, I disagree, so let's alter that a little bit. And then the Supreme Court steps in and mediates that, right? This is going to make that so much more difficult for really big cases. So what I would add is that it runs counter, actually, to the whole point of having a federal court if you don't have nationwide relief, right? So say there's a company that's doing bad things in one state, but they sell things in another state. The classic example, actually, that I can think of is there's a coal company, and a coal company is dumping coal into a river. And the river goes from the top of the country all the way downstream to the bottom of the country, right? It goes across multiple states. If you sue the company in the state that it's dumping the coal into the river, but the states downriver being affected by the toxic coal coming into the river also have to sue, then here what's going to happen is that there's still going to be coal, right, being dumped into the river until that's resolved at every step of the way. And it's going to cost a ton of money. I'm talking a lot of money and time. That's why you want one statement, and then the court can weigh in if it becomes worse. Anyway, I hope I'm making sense. The whole point is that this is going to make it very, very expensive for people to hire lawyers and to seek actual results for their issues. It means that the lobbyists are going to be winning in these niche areas on things like the environment, on things to do with national parks, on things that have to do with the oceans, right? Because the oceans, the coastline extends past state boundaries and jurisdictions.
Sure. Okay, so if I am trying to delve into what you're saying, you're giving an example of if a company operates in multiple states, but the federal court branch only has jurisdiction over a particular area, then the company, which operates in multiple areas, would have to be challenged in each of those areas because one court no longer would have the capacity to act in a nationwide aegis.
Effectively, what it would mean, at least as I understand it, is that the Supreme Court would have the jurisdiction over the country. That it wouldn't be... So how the federal court system works is you seek a resolve to your case initially in the... It's the district court, then the appeals court, then the Supreme Court, right? So federal judges are appointed for life. Once you get the job, you got the job and retire or get ousted from the job. That's a whole different topic. There's that really old judge who was into their, I think, their 90s, and they tried to, like, politely tell them, stop hearing cases.
Come to your retirement party on Friday, and by the way, please leave.
They had all sorts of competency tests. It was a whole thing, but it's one of the few jobs where they have so much power that even when they retire, they can still go on the, like, retiree circuit. They can travel from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, still weigh in as judges. It's an interesting profession. But the point is that there's a tiered system. So your first step, if you have a problem with the federal government or federal issue that the federal government covers, mainly this is something like interstate commerce, trade, things like piracy, air travel, the national parks. So to give you an example of where this is problematic, the national park system has their own federal court. They have their own court, and if the cases that they hear cover only like their jurisdiction, it's not going to affect park rangers and national parks across the country. You'd have to go to like different. It's a mess. But the point I'm making is that how the system works now, or how it worked, was that you go to the district court, and then the judge weighs in. If you need immediate relief, they can issue things like what we've been seeing with the immigration stuff, the temporary restraining order, and that would affect all federal government action, right? Which makes sense, right? If you've got somebody who's transporting, if you've got government enforcement where they're transporting somebody over state lines or between jurisdictions, then you have to have an order that applies to all of those jurisdictions, since effectively what could happen. And this is an issue that happens actually with state laws that are broken, is that people leave like state boundaries and they go just out of the reach of a state jurisdiction.
They skip town.
And unless the other states want to play ball, the people just run away, right? They just leave. The best example I can think of right now for that would be some of the abortion laws and people going to Washington to seek medical services that are banned or illegal in their own states. Or the other one, it would be to transgender medical procedures, where the state of Texas, to give you an example, asked the state of Washington for all medical records of people seeking transgender injuries within the state of Washington. And Washington told Texas pretty much pound sand, we're not going to give you the information. The point is that states have this issue of enforcement. The federal government shouldn't have this issue of enforcement, because ostensibly the federal government, no matter where you are in the country, extends its jurisdiction over the entire country. So if something happens on the East Coast, technically, it should also be the same law applied on the West Coast, if it is a national law that applies to the country. That's why you go to federal court, to get relief for federal issues, right? Especially for federal jurisdiction. This has to, especially to do with aviation, telecommunications, anything to do with interstate commerce. So you go to the district court, you go to the appeals court, and then the appeals court can appeal, right, to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court then decides to weigh in. The whole process is supposed to be that the Supreme Court only weighs in, not only, but usually only weighs in, if there's a disagreement between two different results between those appeals courts about these national issues. And then they'll weigh in and they'll resolve that issue as the sort of final place to resolve it. But if the Supreme Court declines to weigh in, then the whole point is that the declination is in effect them agreeing with the decision of the lower court, and that decision then would apply to the entire country. That's the point, is that it would set a precedent that you then build on for future cases. In this circumstance, that precedent building no longer, that it makes it way, way longer to build any kind of agreement about how things should be. And this is going to be a real issue for things, birthright citizenship, if they let that go. Because this is a constitutional issue of the post-slavery, actually, during the Reformation of the U.S. government after the Civil War, right? That the whole point is that if the government says something is something, like in the Constitution, it says you are a citizen if you're born in the United States, then that applies in every state, every territory, anything that can, you know, can be called the United States of America, period. There is no exception. This is creating a window, a niche, an opportunity for an exception. That sucks, right? Because it seems to, at least on its face, directly violate the U.S. Constitution's Equal Protection Clause, that you're supposed to have equal protection of the laws in every state, irrespective of who's in power in that state. And that this is messy. I don't like this decision at all. I don't like the outcome.
And this is a tangent, but who knows how long decisions like this stay. Like, it seems to, if it was 6-3, then it was probably down partisan line. These are, of course, there are 11 federal courts, federal court districts, and they're federal. So one wonders if they only would have jurisdiction over their areas, how federal are they? And one would also think, if the Supreme Court gives to itself the authority that was previously vested in this district court, in these district courts, aren't they just going to have too much work to do? Where's the limit here? Something doesn't give. Something doesn't add up in my mind.
I'll give you an example that irked me when it was said by the administration, because I was like, you're missing the point. They said that they couldn't have trials for everyone who's being deported because it would just take too much time to give everyone due process. But the whole point of government is it's not about how much time it takes. It's that everybody who interacts with the government is meant to be treated equally. The very fact that they're denying access to justice for any group means that some groups are being treated unequally. A great book to read, actually, about this is called Gideon v. Wainwright. It's when people didn't have lawyers when they were being charged with crimes. And so the whole point of Gideon v. Wainwright is that you have a right, if you're too poor, to be appointed a lawyer to help defend you in court, because court is way too complex, right? That the game is rigged against those who don't have enough money if you don't understand the process and what's going on, because there are procedural issues. There's issues with understanding how the law applies. There's issues with something like this, where the law changes and affects different places in different ways. And you're right. It's a very difficult argument to make that the federal courts are making decisions that affect federal government action if they're constrained only to the jurisdictions of however many states they cover. And 11 districts is not 50 districts. It's not 50 states. It's a grouping of the states. And so it's a whole issue. Gideon v. Wainwright is that people were being denied lawyers, and then they were being given the death penalty. And if one state, the death penalty is probably a great example, actually. The federal government vacillates between having the death penalty, not having the death penalty, depending on the administration, right? Some presidents really want to execute people. Trump is one of those presidents. He brought back the death penalty, and he tried to expedite it for his first term. He tried to just get all those cases through the courts, get these people on the chopping block, and other presidents say no. And there was a window of time where there was a real disagreement, actually, between state courts and the federal courts over whether the death penalty was even legal. And there's a whole list of criminals who had the death penalty and then had their sentences moved down to life without a parole because of that whole disagreement, that some people who probably would have been executed by the death penalty were not executed in our lifetimes, because of the fact that there was this real disagreement between whether how the death penalty was applied was cruel and unusual punishment. And here's the deal. The cruel and unusual punishment clause is a U.S. constitutional provision, but it's a U.S. protection that's a civil right for everyone. So this is a civil rights issue that we're talking about. We're talking about on the level of Brown v. Board of Education, school segregation enforcement, of desegregation, of making sure that, of calling in the National Guard effectively. If the courts aren't equally agreeing on jurisdictions and a federal injunction, of injunctive relief, then it's going to be really messy and expensive. Because on the one hand, they're saying, like, you're going to have to just have more lawsuits. On the other hand, the government is saying, point blank, we're not going to hire enough judges, and we're not going to hear all the cases. Remember, already, the Supreme Court only hears a tiny fraction of the number of appeals that they get, of requests they get every year to hear cases. A very tiny fraction. And that's mainly a function of, frankly, finite resources. There's only so many of them. There's only so many clerks. And so they pick and choose very carefully what cases they hear and why. And the way that worked, that it even made sense, was that when they rejected a decision sent to them by the lower courts and the decision then stood, that decision would apply as a precedent on the entire country. That was one of the, in effect, the ways that the Supreme Court managed to expedite issues and save time, right? That people could still have their issues heard, could still have a final say, but the final say was effectively, no, we agree, right? This is going to have, no, we agree, in 18 different places, or 11 different places, right? If it's 11 different courts, it's going to be a mess. It's a whole mess, right? Because people do class action suits. They do tort lawsuits. They do issues that affect multiple states across multiple districts, right? If something happens in both California and New York and Hawaii, are you going to have to hear it in three different courts at the same time? This is a whole mess. I don't like it. I don't like it at all.
It's a brave new world. Brazen new world. Yeah, something like that.
Cruel. It's a cruel new world, right?
Cruel summer, yeah.
It's going to be more expensive if you don't have the money to fly to multiple states across multiple time zones. You're just not, in some cases, people are just not going to have their case heard. They're just not going to get the justice they might otherwise have had.
Okay, so I got one more question on this. The Trump administration is not the first to do this, this being what is to follow here. If you want a certain kind of decision, it used to be you might go to the Ninth Circuit if you want a liberal decision. You might go to the Fifth Circuit if you want a conservative decision. You know what I'm saying here?
Oh, no, I hear what you're saying. There's a court in Texas.
To tie up the question, just to give the complete question, that seems to me a little bit like, how did this come about? Maybe that shouldn't have been. Maybe it should have been like one pool of judges spread evenly across all, so there wasn't this. But like, how did that come about? Sorry for interrupting.
Oh, I get what you're saying. And that is definitely, as a counterpoint, you're right. That's definitely an issue of court shopping, where there's this one court in Texas that they just really like sending cases to because they feel they get a better decision. The other example would be for the classified documents case, where his case was heard down in Florida, where ostensibly it was like a random draw, but it was a random draw between a handful of judges to hear the case. And oh, look, it's the one that really likes Trump. But the whole point is that, yes, I get that issue, and that is an issue. But my answer to that was, it's always about trade-offs. So yes, that's an issue, no question. But there is an answer to that, which is that you then appeal it to the Supreme Court. The issue here is that you're going to have now more than one of those courts, and then you're going to have to appeal all of those cases in all of those circumstances, effectively, to the court. And there's no guarantee the court will listen. Because again, and this is where I really don't like how the issue with this decision is, that the court is very picky with the cases it chooses. And so this reduces the likelihood that cases will be heard by the court if you increase the volume of cases that they have to choose from which to hear. Right? If they're only listening to, 300 cases, but they get upwards of 10,000 or so requests to hear cases or in a year. When I was in college, we ran through in one of my classes what the actual numbers were. And it was pretty staggering. They only hear a tiny fraction of all the requests they get throughout a year. And the whole issue here is, it's going to be a problem of numbers, is that even in the circumstance you're citing, that's one case, right? So that one case can be appealed. Everybody can file their amicus briefs. It's all heard and it's resolved there when it's appealed there. If you have multiple cases, then that means that the amount of resources required to levy a response effectively is going to be more. It's going to be more time, more hours. This might be great for lawyers. I mean, they're probably going to have to hire more lawyers, especially lawyers who can argue cases in front of a federal judge, right? There's a whole separate requirement to become a lawyer in front of the Supreme Court. You have to be one of the special ones, one of the good lawyers, right? Because there's a very limited number of lawyers who actually can argue in front of the Supreme Court. It's interesting. But anyway, the point I'm making is already the numbers are bad for people being able to afford to file these kinds of lawsuits, which is why they have a collective action. They have things like the ACLU, or they have things like the NAACP, or you've got nonprofit groups that pool their resources and then file one big lawsuit and try to win there. If you split it up all across the country in 11 different jurisdictions, you have to have 11 different lawsuits, for example. Lawsuits cost a lot of money to actually go to court. And if you want an actual response from the Supreme Court, you have to go to court and you have to actually have some kind of trial. Like, usually plea deals not going to cut it, because these are issues that the word is contentious. I'm trying to think of, there's a specific word for it, whether it's moot or, there you go, moot, whether it's moot or not. And this muddies that. This makes it more complicated. Anyways, I know I'm talking in sort of jargon language.
That's why it's called Mondays with Mike.
Yeah. But it also, look, it speaks to the values that we have in our country. Effectively, that if you're on the streets, sidewalks of California, or you're found in the desert in Texas, or you're up in the mountains in Colorado, it doesn't matter where you are. If you go to the court and they make a decision, that decision should affect everybody who lives in the country equally, right? If they say just period, right? That's how it should work for a federal court, not a state court. State courts apply to state laws and state jurisdictions. No. Federal court, federal country. Mm-hmm. And this just makes it so much weirder, because if it actually goes into effect for the birthright citizenship thing, they're effectively saying, this is why I just seriously disagree with this. They're effectively saying that in any state that doesn't directly contest the executive order in court through a lawsuit, through like a, you know, a filed, submitted lawsuit that gets heard and blah, 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 all that, that there's a question that somebody born in the U.S. might not be a citizen. So what then? Are they stateless? Are they a citizen of whatever country they come from? What if they're an unaccompanied minor? What if they're an orphan? What if their parents died in transit and they're a little baby and they're found in the desert? What's going to happen then? Are we going to just send people to... It doesn't make sense, because the whole point of the U.S. Constitution, if you carefully read it, is it's the supreme law of the land. Read it, right? Like, part of it in there is anything that's not reserved to the federal government is reserved to the states. Okay, so that means that they have to clarify what's reserved to the federal government. And in this case, that's the Constitution, the amendments, the Bill of Rights, all those things. Those are explicitly applied to everyone because of the Equal Protection Clause. This makes that complicated. It makes it worse, and I don't like it. I think that future courts are going to have to revisit this, and there's going to be serious questions raised about what these justices were thinking when they made this decision. Because I think they're dropping the ball, if I'm being honest, what their job is, at least on this one.
If there's a boom for lawyers, maybe we should take the bar. If it's a boom time for lawyers. Okay, do you want to talk about trade talks with Canada and tax target? Does tax target American companies? This was reported recently that Trump tweeted, a lowercase t tweeted, that he was ending all trade talks with Canada because they put a 3% tax on certain U.S. companies for digital services. And he says it's a blatant attack on U.S. interests. Is this the madman theory of international relations in action?
No, this is Trump doing a public service announcement for all the rich tech companies that backed him. The Elon Musks of the world, Bezos, the Google, those people. This is his way of saying, of using leverage, actually, of the trade deal to try use a negotiating tactic and get Canada to back down. Because if there's one thing that is universally true of almost all these tech companies, is that they come up with very creative ways to never pay a dime in taxes. Very creative ways. Headquarters in strange countries, odd ways of moving their money around the world. So it looks like, anyway, the whole point is that they have very creative, very fascinating ways to remove their tax burden to as low as humanly possible. And what Canada is doing is saying, you're just going to have to give us a little bit of the money, a tiny fraction of the money, 3% of any money you make off Canadian users. You're just going to have to do that before you do all your tax math of not paying any money in taxes. You're just going to have to give us a little bit of the gross revenue of the money you get in, period. No creative accounting, no whatever. Just give us some of the money. That's it. And I think the tech company is like, we don't want to give any money. It's actually, to be blunt, this is like the opening salvo of international tax politics, because the view goes like this, at least as far as I understand it. If one country can impose a 3% tax on the gross revenue of digital services for all Canadian users, then all the countries can impose a 3% tax on the gross revenue of the digital services of citizens of their countries. And 3% of all the global revenues of these huge tech companies is 3% of all the global revenues of these tech companies. And when we're talking about billions of dollars, or in some cases, trillions of dollars of value, they don't like it. They don't like paying any money at all in taxes. And this shakes that up. This makes it increases the regulatory burden when you have companies that are famous for laying off 10%, 15% of their workforce so that they can make it look like they're being productive, blah, blah, blah. Frankly, if this goes into effect, they're going to have to hire a whole bunch of accountants and tax lawyers and people whose only job is to just sit there and make sure that the money is going where they're legally required to send the money, because their permission to operate in any country is granted by that country. That's what being a corporation is. You're given a permission to make money by a country. And if you don't follow the rules and the laws that they say you have to follow, you don't get to make any money, right? Because they can just snatch your ability to do that away from you. So these companies have to comply if they want to make money, which they are making money from these countries. Yeah, I understand why Trump is doing this, because the powers that be, as it were right now, probably gave a little phone call, because he's notorious for just talking to people on the phone all the time. They probably called him up and they're like, hey, Mr. Goldman, Mr. Donald man, remember that time we all chipped in millions of dollars for your inauguration and we publicly backed you in a huge, visible way and gave you gravitas and power and time to collect, right? Time for you to pony up on your end of this bargain of us funding you and backing you and not allowing editorials to be published of our newspapers endorsing Kamala Harris. All the moves we made to ensure that you got put in this place, right? This is it. This is your moment. And it is. It's his moment, right? Because he has leverage through the trade deals, because Canada obviously wants a trade deal with the US. We are a huge percentage of their economy. They need us more than we need them. They really need us. If you look at the numbers, it's stark. Canada really needs the US. So it doesn't surprise me. It's not madman at all. He's trying to use it as leverage, as a negotiating tactic to say, throw this in as a sweetener. Take away the tax, we'll give you a trade deal. Don't take away the tax. No trade deal. We go back to this huge tariff situation that just completely is a mess. We don't want that. You don't want that. We don't want that. But it's what we're going to have if you don't do what we're asking. I'm not so sure Canada is going to comply, right? Because every government likes revenue. They like taxes if they can get away with it. And 3% isn't huge, but also it helps to curtail the more egregious actions of companies if you impose a tax on them, because then they have to account for what their revenue is fully within the country. It helps Canada better understand what it is that these companies are doing to their people, which helps them better regulate the tools that they're using to engage with the Canadian audiences in Canada through social media, through the internet, through sales platforms. It helps them better account, as it were, through forensic accounting, where the actual sales are from. It helps better document just the whole thing, right? Like, how are these companies making money and what is their actual tax burden in Canada? That could also be the issue, I think, is that it helps Canada in some ways figure out the rest of the tax burden that these companies owe to Canada for other taxes if they have to rigorously account for this 3% digital tax on all the stuff. You know, it's just more evidence, more tools in the toolkit of enforcement. So I get that. Like, I understand that part of it. Yeah, but no, not madman. It's a negotiating tactic. It's leverage.
Okay. We'll see what follows. Mondays with Mike.